HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 97, recorded live Monday, January 14th, 2008. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Sean Wildermuth about ADO.NET Services, a.k.a. Project Astoria.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and this week we'll be talking about ADO.NET Data Services, formerly Project Codenamed Astoria, and we're talking today with community member, ADO guy, and all-around database brilliance, Sean Wildermuth. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's good to finally get you on the show. You've been on DNR a couple of times, and we always hang out at the conferences, but I haven't had you on the show. This is show 97 now.
That's amazing. 97 shows? Really?
You're helping us here on the march to show 100.
And what do you have planned for show 100?
I don't know. That's a good question. Probably a introspective retrospective with a lot of sappy music and maybe a bloopers show. I don't know. That's a good question. So you and I have been talking on the email recently about Astoria and Project Astoria, which was released with the ASP.NET 3.5 extensions, but isn't explicitly an ASP.NET 3.5 thing. And
no.
Before, it was kind of an internal research project, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know about internal. Before it was released as ADO.NET Data Services, it was kind of released to the community as, hey, look at this, tell us if it's interesting or not. There were some regional demonstrations of it, and you could kind of play with the bits to see what the data team was up to in kind of this REST space.
Okay, so let's back up for a second, because not every listener will know what REST means, although they probably have heard the term REST. I know what it means. Tell me, what is REST?
Well, REST is really just it stands for representational state transfer. The idea of or an URL-based API instead of a SOAP-based API for things like web services, where I can execute a request over HTTP usually. In a single URL that includes all the information about the data I want to come back. It's in a lot of ways, it's a more simple representation than SOAP. It doesn't have, semantics for doing for doing deep levels of security, or, it's for, I would like to go to this place and get this information or post this information or whatever the case may be. Early on in the SOAP discussion and web services, there were kind of two camps, the REST camp that thought SOAP was too complicated and SOAP camp that thought that REST wasn't mature enough. And I don't know that that ever got resolved.
Now, REST was originally a guy's PhD thesis, and there are a lot of people who feel very strongly about REST from a purity perspective. I think Don Box calls them Restifarians. that if something that is POX, POX, or plain old XML, where I visit a URL and some XML comes back, or I post something to a URL and something happens, that's not necessarily representational of REST. No pun intended.
Sure.
I think, isn't it important that REST lean on some of the existing HTTP verbs? Because there's GET and there's POST, but there's also a whole series of other verbs that are not often used. And people who feel very strongly about REST usually want those verbs to have meaning. Is that correct?
To the best of my knowledge, I'm certainly not a Restifarian. I haven't been in that camp much. What I do see is that using all the verbs, and really the four verbs that most people seem to be most passionate about are, obviously post and get, but also put and delete, which interestingly map very well to the four verbs in CRUD for data access. Create, update, insert, and delete.
Right. Create, read, update, delete.
Yeah, read. I was missing one of them.
Okay, so there's this discussion about REST, but let's move more to the pragmatic. If I understand correctly here, that people who initially are exposed to ADO.NET data services, they think that they check a box and then your database is available via web services. I'm sure that's an oversimplification. Is that what we're talking about?
It would be grossly inaccurate to say that. Because really what Astoria does is allows you to take some data model, whether that is entity framework-based or in the bits that should be coming soon, they've promised to give us Link for SQL-based data models and then expose them over REST or over the web. So it's not about taking the objects that are in your database, but the objects that you use normally in .NET code and then exposing them via a web interface.
Okay. So a lot of people think about the co-opetition that happens at Microsoft, the idea that this team is cooperating but also competing with this other team. And they wonder sometimes, is there a master plan? And sometimes I think that there's a master plan, and other times I think that people are just doing the best they can to come up with cool stuff.
Sure.
And I was initially kind of suspicious about this project, and I was thinking, how is this a good idea? You know, is this going to compete with Link to SQL or compete with Entity Framework? And sometimes people think that Link to SQL and Entity Framework are competing with each other. But you brought up a really interesting point that while Link to SQL might allow you to see more of the physical aspects of your database, if you have a products table, you might end up with products objects. The Entity
Correct.
Framework provides you with a layer of abstraction, right, that gives you a logical data model that it may very well be different from what's going on in the database.
Correct, and also provide an abstraction between changes of the database and what memory objects you're using in the in .NET code traditionally.
So then the ADO.NET Data Services or Project Astoria can sit on currently on the Entity Framework, but in the future, on the near future, on top of Link to SQL as well. It's a layer on top of both of those.
Correct. In fact, what they have publicly said is that it should be able to sit on top of any iQueryable data source. So you can imagine any Link for SQL enabled, I'm sorry, any linkable object, so that if you took LBGen Pro, if you took the Link for Amazon stuff, you could throw a story on top of all of that.
Interesting. So even though it's called ADO.NET Data Services, it's not tied to ADO. You could use any data source, whether it be a file or a web service or something that can be used via link. You use the term iQueryable, being an interface that you have to implement in order to be involved in a link query. So then anything that I have that can be involved in a link query could then be exploited with the ADO.NET Data Services.
That's on their roadmap. That isn't the way it quite works today, but my understanding is that's the way it will work by release.
Okay. So then you think about what are some of the other things I could serialize this at. I might not want to necessarily serialize it as XML. I might want to serialize it as JSON, as JavaScript object notation. Can I do that as well?
You can, and in fact, they've taken kind of an interesting approach there. The current bits that are out there today actually serialize in only two formats, JSON and an XML representation that is actually based on Atom. It's not a
And what is Atom?
Old. Actually, I don't know what that stands for. It's a syndication format similar to RSS.
Right. I don't think Atom actually stands for anything.
Oh, good.
I think that Sam Ruby and those guys just made the name, and it's not RSS. It's a syndication format.
It is a syndication format. Again, on their roadmap is they're looking at whether to support plain old XML as well as a serialization format. So you can think about with kind of the Ajaxification of the web in the last few years and how hot that was. If you had data sitting somewhere in your back end, somewhere in your services, that you wanted to be able to get at from the client, from whether it's an Ajax, whether it's a rich client Silverlight or even Flash or Flex. The idea here is that you can make simple web requests up and get data back. Now, the important part about the way Astoria is different than this is it's really talking about exposing endpoints. So let's say if I had a product endpoint. Instead of saying, I'm going to expose a web service method that says, get products by date, or get products for this customer, or get products from this supplier. And what's happened in the web service space is people often have had to create and pollute their API layer with lots of different calls for very specific reasons. Mm-hmm. The Astoria takes a different approach, whereas the URL or the URI syntax allows you to specify how you want to get the data. So we have this product's endpoint, and I may say in my actual URL call, I want the products, and I want the products who has stock less than 5, whose price is greater than this, order it by this, etc. And even mm-hmm. shape the result sets by asking for it to get, you know, nested objects as well. So instead of, you know, this idea of exposing specific calls or specific queries out, it's really about exposing part of your model out so that, developers using this from the client can really get at the kind of data they need.
Okay. So my as you were saying this, my initial fear was like, okay, now we're allowing ad hoc SQL and they can just type it in directly to the URI into the address bar, which I suppose could be a scenario. But I'm hearing that there are a whole series of access management techniques that would allow you to expose some of the options for parameters within a query, but not ad hoc queries. I mean, I might be able to say, give me order IDs where the order is this ID or that ID. But that doesn't mean just because I can go and query for any order ID that I could potentially start querying for customers or querying for products.
Correct.
I have control over what's going on in that URI.
By default, it doesn't expose anything from your model, and as you design your story of service or your data services layer, it's a fairly simple thing to allow or disallow both verbs and nouns. So I want to expose the products from my model, but not the customers. I want to expose reading, but not writing. I want to expose updating, but not inserting, things like that.
Okay. Now, is this something that I would be running on my web server? I mean, I think that
it is.
Okay, and so this is not something running on the SQL server.
Correct. No, it's running on the web server because you're querying against the model, not against the database. The fact that model becomes a database call is a side effect, but is not, you know, if you can imagine a story over a link for Amazon, what's really going to happen in the background is it's going to generate a call to Amazon, not some database query. So you're not putting in, you know, ad hoc SQL, you're putting in a this query language that a story has come up with to allow you to look at these items. It's not generate. It's not allowing you to put, you know, straight SQL in and putting it in, so you don't have any of the problems of you know, SQL injection attacks and that sort of thing.
That makes sense. So it definitely was a lot of kind of FUD, a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt around this.
Absolutely.
Where it was like, well, you install this on your SQL server. This is all not true. Install this on your SQL server, push a button, and then everything's available, and you can query it with the browser.
No, we had that. It was called SQL XML, and it was a horribly bad idea that no one used.
It was a bad idea.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we install this on our web server, and everything is turned off by default. So all access to the data store is turned off. We can go and initialize our service and decide what resources and what access rules we want. I understand that there's the notion of containers, so you can partition your logical data model and decide what people have access to, and decide which entry point into the system that you want to grant access to.
Correct.
And then if I was going to write an application, like a console application that would start talking to it, just like I make in Link to SQL, like maybe a Northwind data context, I guess in Astoria, I make a web data context and then just start talking to it like any linkable thing.
Well, there's two approaches here. There is a client-side library, and there's one for, you know, rich clients, full .NET applications. There's also one for Silverlight that was just released that is still a bit in flux, where you have that notion of context.
Okay.
You know, the other thing you also have is it's just a web call, right? And so if you ended up wanting to manage it yourself, you're just getting data and you just wanted to work with from JavaScript, you can just execute web requests. It's not limited to simply using their library. Their library certainly makes it easier, but when it gets closer to the metal, it is just a web request that returns JSON or XML.
So as someone who thinks about things kind of in a larger architectural context myself, I always wonder, well, is this the data access layer? I mean, ordinarily I would write that layer and then we'd have this translation between what's coming out of the database and what I would think of as a business object.
Right.
More and more people are using DTOs, data transfer objects, which don't have any smarts. They're not some of the big smart business objects of the 90s.
Right.
I'm wondering these entities that are being moved around who is calling this? Is it my business logics calling my Astoria REST services? Is it my data? Is this replacing my data access layer?
I don't think so, because I think the fact that there's a library for smart clients is more for the remote smart client story. It's not for the traditional enterprise development. You would still use the business objects you've always used, and whether they were generated with something like Linkra SQL, the entity framework, NDoc, or LLBGen Pro, or whatever the tool was you're using, those are still going to be your business objects in memory. This is allowing you to be able to have access to those same set of business objects across the internet. And that's the important point here.
Okay, so this is about providing access over the net in the format that people are now comfortable with, you know, REST and JSON and angle brackets. But this is not necessarily turning my database access layer on its ear. If I've already got a good layer, this would allow me to exploit that a little more, but I don't need to, it's not implying that there's a new way to do things entirely on the data access layer that I should throw away.
Let me put it this way. That's what I believe. Now, as we see Microsoft guys out of the data team demo this, you may hear a different story, but I really think the way they've architected this is really about, I've already got my data. I've got my data objects that I'm using in my traditional .NET development, my traditional enterprise development, where we're all in the same domain. We're all in the same building sometimes, or maybe in the same VPN. But I'd like to be able to expose some of that data out to partner sites or out to customer sites, and typically I've written a couple of web pages to do that, and I'd like to take my existing data and then have a way to transport it across the internet, across 80 or 443, and just make it work.
Okay, so now people may be wondering, how does this relate to WCF and to what was formerly called Indigo, and is this competing with WCF?
It's actually not. It's actually built on top of the WCF 3.5 REST stack. So they're eating their own dog food. This isn't a whole new invention. They're using that stuff to actually build this.
Well, that's refreshing.
Yeah, it is actually.
I mean, I guess I'm not supposed to say that as an employee of the company, but it's like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, yeah.
It's actually built on something that we'd already done.
Which is good, because a lot of the same semantics, they're very comfortable. When you look at, you're looking at SVC endpoints, you can configure them with traditional WCF. But if you're using the Astoria stuff, it is kind of drop and go. You end up developing a single class where you write a little bit of code that says, I have this model. These are the parts of the model I want to expose. These are the verbs for the model I want to expose. And you're done.
Okay, so if this is plugging into that WCF REST stuff, then it's just using web service host, and then it would probably make the contract that you would have with that REST endpoint just a URI template star, and then Astoria, the ADO.NET data services, would then be allowed to decide what to do about that URI. So it looks like they've designed their own kind of URI to match what makes them comfortable.
That's my understanding. And that has, over the original CTP and through this latest version, that has morphed a little as they found out that it works better or worse with Firefox or with IE or with some of the other browsers. So the syntax has been changing a little over the CTPs to try to get it right. There's also some discussion about, under Firefox, delete and put aren't treated as first-class citizens like post and get are, and how to get around those facts. But the Astoria is really trying to handle that underneath the covers for you.
Yeah, I understand that getting those kinds of things through firewalls, getting anything other than get or post through a firewall, also can be a real challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not sure where that'll actually get to, where they'll actually handle that, whether everything will be a post with special monikers or what. I think that's something they're still delving into to try to determine the best way to do it. I got most interested in this because it seemed like the natural place to get data for Silverlight, because I'm more interested in the line of business app story of Silverlight than I am the video player. And being able to get data from my servers, when I'm doing traditional ASP.NET, I can, create markup with HTML and then ship it out to the server because I have access to that. from the client, because Silverlight's written really in the client's face in the browser. It's been a challenge, you know, do you write a web service for each and every call do you want to do?
Exactly.
Or what? This has been a really good compliment to that as far as I'm concerned.
See, this is very good. This is helping me get put this into context, because I was like, what is this for? What is this competing with? How is this complementary? But it seems if you're going to be doing a lot of Ajax applications, and which means that you are going to be exposing a lot of data on the web anyway, this is a really good choice for getting that data out.
Especially if you have existing models, yes.
Right, if you're going to be using the same models. I mean, certainly we have, and one could be using this, doing this manually. You could make an ASMX web service, and you could expose that as JSON. You could do all of this manually with HTTP handlers. But if you have a good understanding of what your model looks like, and you feel comfortable exposing that kind of that mindset, you know, your the way you've modeled your data out to the web, then this is a very minimally difficult way to do this. I mean, you install some bits on your web server, you point it at your database, and then there's a client library either for .NET clients or for Silverlight that hide the fact that you're using HTTP. And then you just start querying it.
Exactly. One of the more difficult, when I've talked about this in front of groups at MSDN events and such, one of the big questions is, well, how secure is it? Well, you know, the reality is you're bringing data into the client, which means it's not secure. Regardless of the transport mechanism, if you're bringing in social security numbers from your employees and putting them in the browser, I can look with a memory profile in 3 minutes and see what data is there. I can hack up the JavaScript, whatever it is. So you still need to be careful about what data you're going to expose via Astoria, because you're still talking about code that's running in the client's machine. And if you don't want people to look at that data, you should still be using the server. You know, let's say you wanted, you know, to find out the total sales for a sales department. You're not going to drop down all the salespeople's information into the browser and then do all the calculations to show some graph. You're going to present summary data down to the browser for a number of reasons.
Right, right. Because you're not, I mean, like, you're not exposing, you have control over what gets exposed. I mean, you're not,
absolutely,
like, people don't freak out because Facebook has an REST API. I mean, you can call Facebook's API yourself, and you can fool around with the URI, and you can start pulling data back out of Facebook. But they're not concerned that you're going to bring the system down by doing ad hoc queries, because you can't do ad hoc queries.
Correct.
You can get to what they've chosen to let you get to via the URI and nothing else.
And the story's the same with Astoria.
Okay. So we've got link to REST now.
Sort of. It's kind of link on both ends, which is kind of the weird part, because if you wanted to expose your own sorts of even verbs, let's say you wanted to actually implement something like, you know, get data that retrieves some very specific, you know, generated code, you would still, as far as the story is concerned, you would still expose that as a linkable or an iQueryable interface at the end. So that the client library is going to let you do link over the results, but at the other end of the wire, Astoria is having you do link to return, really a query across the wire.
I see. The serialization format is what it is, but we'll be doing link to the local data on the client side, and then we may or may not be using link on the back end.
Actually, the reverse. You will be using link on the back end. You may or may not be using it on the client.
Oh, yeah. Actually, right. Forgive me. You're absolutely right.
Obviously, link for JavaScript is a couple weeks away, so...
Oh, really?
No, I'm kidding. I don't know when link will work in JavaScript.
Well, you know, it's amazing what you can get done in JavaScript. It's pretty much blown my mind. I mean, just when I thought you couldn't do XYZ, someone writes a complete version of Solitaire entirely in JavaScript.
Sure.
So, yeah, if it can be done in JavaScript, I'm sure that somebody will do it.
Yeah, that, you know... That could start a whole different discussion we could have on a whole another experimental project, but I'll leave that to another talk.
Oh, okay. With a little teaser there. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come talk to us, and I'll put up links to your blog and up to Mike Flasco's blog and the different folks over on Astoria. And if you've got any samples or anything cool that you want people to see, if you put a post up in your blog for me, Sean, and we'll link to it.
Sure. I'd also suggest people link to or visit silverlightdata.com. which is a little experimental site I have. It's Silverlight using Astoria to show database data. And you can link to the and download the complete example.
I like examples. Source code is good.
Yep. Well, thanks for having me.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for taking the time. And this has been another episode of Hansel Minutes. We'll see you again next week.